Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Memoirs about people from cultures different than your own want you to read them. They are not writing for their own. And I think that's the biggest kind of takeaway.
Vivian Halloran looked at food memoirs for her book, The Immigrant Kitchen. She'll speak with Maddie and Lee of the Indiana University Food Institute about, among other things, the complicated notion of authentic cuisine. From harvest, some dairy farmers are starting to make and sell cheese to local markets. Then we spend time with former chef Dan Williamson. He describes his long journey from food insecurity growing up, to cooking in France, to giving up his career as a chef. Gotta get our news fix first with Mark Chilla.
How low can it go? That's what many in farm country asked about the farm economy this week, after the Agriculture Department forecast another plunge this year in profits for farmers. Net farm income will fall 8.7% from last year's levels, according to the year's first forecast produced by the USDA's Economic Research Service. If realized, that would mark the fourth straight year of profit declines, after 2013 saw record highs. The price of foundational crops like corn and wheat have slipped dramatically in recent years, thanks in large part to global oversupply, leaving many farmers struggling to break even. While the short-term outlook remains bleak for most farmers, the farm economy has not yet reached a crisis point, economists say. Many farmers booked profits during recent boom years and will depend on cash or assets, as well as government safety net payouts to ride out lean years. Government farm safety net programs are forecast to pay out $13 billion to farmers in 2017. A California prosecutor has filed charges against a poultry ranch after an investigation found 28,000 hens in unsanitary and crowded conditions. The charges against Hoburg Poultry Ranches include 39 alleged violations of a new law banning crowded cages. This case marks the first time the law has been invoked since it passed nearly a decade ago. If convicted, the ranch owner, 70-year-old Robert Hoburg, faces 180 days in jail for each violation of the cage rules and a year in jail for each animal cruelty charge. In 2008, California voters passed the Standards for Confining Farm Animals initiative, which requires cages for some farm animals to allow them to lie down, stand up, and fully extend their limbs. And researchers have developed a new wheat-like species called Salish Blue. It's a cross between wheat and its wild cousin, wheat grass. Their goal was to make something that's like wheat but is perennial. Normal wheat dies every year, and farmers have to till the soil and plant new seeds. Not only does that mean more work, but the process also causes erosion, which makes farmland less healthy and can carry sediment and agricultural chemicals into nearby waters. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union claimed it had created a plant exactly like wheat that kept regenerating itself year after year. But as NPR tells it, the Soviets were bluffing, and in 2017, we still had no perennial grain crops on a wide scale. That is, until Salish Blue. You can read more about this on our website. That's at eartheats.org.
Mark, good day to you.
Thanks. To you too.
Beyond cheddar and Swiss, fancy cheeses are crowding the dairy aisle these days. And in the Midwest, small farms are offering up many new varieties. We sent Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer to check out what's behind the boom in local cheese.
Come on.
Kevin Dietzel is calling for the cows to come home here at Lost Lake Farm near Jewell, Iowa. He'd always been interested in dairy farming. But when he finally decided to give it a go, he found himself here in central Iowa, where land is expensive and dairy herds are few. Milk prices are notoriously unstable, but reliably low, meaning most dairy farms get big to make money on volume. Dietzel knew his farm would always be small, so he needed a different tact.
My business plan for that was to add value to that milk by making cheese.
I check, and if it's the right consistency, then I cut the curd.
The result is this building. It has a milking parlor on one end, and through a separate entrance, a near sterile looking room filled with stainless steel and food grade plastic. He trades his warm hat and coat for a hairnet and apron and gets to work massaging curds into wheels of cheese. His signature product is Ingrid's Pride, made using Dietzel's own technique and featuring a unique flavor related to the grasses his cows eat. Dietzel's handmade small batch processing means he can sell it for more than a big company like Kraft or Cabot.
We have to do something that's a little bit more original and is also going to be worth that money, so hopefully we're doing that.
Dietzel is part of a growing number of Midwest dairy operators choosing smaller herds and on-farm processing. Iowa State University dairy scientist Stephanie Clark says in her 7 years here, she's seen about 1 to 2 new startups make the investment in cheese each year.
It's amazing the history that we have in Iowa on its own. And then we have quite a lot of success throughout the Midwest.
The math can make sense. With a back-of-the-envelope calculation, Clark says one cow's milk might yield a farmer $13 a day. Turning that milk to cheese could gross $105.
We are talking about specialty cheese. We're talking about smaller farms. Can be artisan, can be farmstead.
They're places making cheese on the same site where the cows are raised and milked. Obviously, there are expenses beyond what a milk-only dairy has. But these small, all-in-one businesses hope to make money with cheeses that fetch a premium, as long as they have a market.
Four cheeses on the plate, 3 of which are Iowa cheeses. We'll start here.
The cheese shop here in Des Moines opened 5 years ago. Owner C.J. Bienert was newly enamored of the tastefulness and variety of American cheeses. He combs the Midwest for the best ones, even stocking a small amount of an apple cider washed rarity from Michigan's Upper Peninsula that he offers for $50 a pound. It's the ultimate local foodie indulgence.
But it sells. You buy a tenth of a pound, you know, $5 worth, a very small little taste, and it's a treat.
10 times what you might pay for a simple block at the supermarket is exceptional. Many of Bienert's other options are still special, but more reasonable. Right now, he says about 70% of the cheeses in his shop are domestic.
I really do believe in the next 5 years, we'll be able to be 80 to 90% American artisan, and we'll have at least a half a dozen, if not a dozen more producers here in Iowa.
Bienert also features cheeses from Missouri, Nebraska, Colorado, and other regions of the country. A simple cheese-centric menu attracts many people for lunch.
I'm a big blue cheese fan, but anything soft and stinky is what I like.
That's Cassie Valick of nearby Newton, Iowa.
I like the Prairie Breeze cheddar. I think those are probably my two favorites. I'm fairly new to Iowa, so I like to get out and explore and try all of the options here.
She's just the kind of customer who may help encourage other small, creative dairy farmers to work with their milk until they can sell it as cheese. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
More stories like these at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Memoirs are a form of hospitality. The author is inviting you into their home, their culture, their food traditions. And when the memoirs contain recipes, well, that's sort of like an extended meal. That's how Vivian Halloran sees it. She's the author of The Immigrant Kitchen, Food, Ethnicity, and the Diaspora. She came into the Earth Eats studios to speak with Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of the Indiana University Food Institute. It just seemed right to start the conversation about food memoirs with some personal stories. You'll hear Lee first, and then Vivian.
So I grew up on the East Coast, and I grew up eating gefilte fish with my Jewish friends, and ziti with my Italian friends, Irish soda bread with my Irish Catholic friends. Mm-hmm. And at home, my mom would make homemade tortillas all the time. And it wasn't until way later in life that I realized that other people didn't actually eat homemade tortillas. And also that this came from my grandfather, who was native New Mexican. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that in terms of immigration, he was a second language English speaker. So he grew up speaking Spanish. Second mm-hmm. language was English. Mm-hmm. And yet his ancestors came in the 1500s to New Mexico. So like most of us in the U.S., you're an immigrant as well. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your ancestry and what had you come to the mainland U.S.
Well, it's kind of an interesting story because you talked about someone who's stayed in place once they immigrated to the New World, and that the border moved around them. Right. So but the tradition of speaking Spanish remained within the family, which mm-hmm. made him so much later than the 1500s a Spanish speaker first. Right. In my case, my father's side of the family came from what was at the time they left still considered Syria. Oh. And they went first to Cuba and then they settled in Puerto Rico. So I grew up with great grandparents who would argue back and forth in Arabic. And my grandfather was the youngest of 11. My relatives, their deal was restaurants. Wow. So that's how they made their living in Puerto Rico when I was growing up. All that to say is that I grew up watching my dad have these moments where he'd be homesick for Lebanese food. And my mother, who was, her father was a Spaniard, and so she did not know how to do this. So we'd get in the car and go over to the Lebanese side of the family, and they would not only feed him then, but give him a whole bunch of foods to tide him over. But I really saw this as a fascinating aspect of his background. I never thought that I was Lebanese, but I knew that we were one of the five Lebanese families in Puerto Rico at the time. And then later, when I was in a sophomore in high school, we left Puerto Rico due to health reasons. My sister needed medical care. My dad was in the Army, so Fitzsimmons Army Medical Base in Colorado was the place we needed to be. And so we moved there, but it took my dad a year to find a compassionate reassignment, somebody who'd swap jobs with him. Wow. And it's in that period when we were first in Colorado waiting for my dad that the neighbors got together and left us this basket of wonderful Thanksgiving goodies. And it was such a warm and welcoming act.
And yet you said they left a card that was not signed by anyone?
Yeah, that's the thing. They were trying to minimize then the potential shame we might have felt. And that's a funny kind of gesture, right? Because it's both a welcome to our neighborhood, we valued you, but also you probably don't know what we do, right? So we took it in the spirit in which it was offered. And a year later, he was able to join us, and so our family was reunited.
You also talk about how the immigrant memoir cookbooks give you a glimpse into exemplary immigrants. What do you mean by that?
Well, part of the problem, if there is one, with choosing this data set, right, this assortment of memoirs, is that most of the people who have the time to both reflect on their experience and then write about it are people who are middle class or upper income. So there's a level in which their experience is indeed the one to whom people refer when they're saying, oh, good immigrants. So I am aware that to not cover them, not mention the people who struggle, who maybe cross boundaries and don't have proper documents,
right,
they're not able to shine a light on their own day-to-day life.
You commented on how the recipe format has changed, too, over time. Could you maybe explain what that change has been like?
Recipe books started being written as a way of transmitting a specific series of ingredients, but not techniques for what to do with them, because they were addressed to people who cooked for a living. Mm-hmm. And then the less familiar people are with cooking, the more explanation that recipes have to have. Now, the interesting thing I discovered is when you write a memoir, you don't need to taste test your recipes. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And so you can very easily tell who is having a recipe they've never actually made.
Yes, I have had that experience with chefs having to make their recipes for them and write them down.
Yeah. And so, so again, when authors write about, oh, we used to go to this fancy restaurant when I was five, and then suddenly at the end of the chapter, there's this recipe for a restaurant that's been out of business for a long time. You know a five-year-old didn't write that down, right? So there's a bit of an element that is constructed. Yes, they went. Yes, they ate this. Yes, their memories are fine. But this is an approximation, and you need to know that.
And oftentimes, the fewer specialty ingredients are included that sometimes make the recipe or remind you so much of the cultural heritage of that recipe. Mm-hmm. I think of dried limes in the cookbook Plenty mm-hmm. and palm sugar and some mm-hmm. of in the cookbook Fat Rice.
And yet, just having to make those substitutions absolutely demonstrate what the process of assimilating to the culture that you're living in, or acculturating, right? It's that you make certain trade-offs in order to get the end result, which is the meal you're yearning for.
Right.
And it can't be authentic if you don't have the ingredients you need, and yet it can be real.
So for you, what's the difference between authentic and real? Because as food scholars, we deal with these ideas a lot, but they're contested and confusing. So what's your take on?
Well, you know, it also goes to that notion of who is the arbiter. Because if you're making the recipe in the way your grandmother and your great-grandmother always made it, but it turns out that their use of ingredients was an accommodation, I think it's authentic to your family, but it may not meet the originality of the ingredients that would make it authentically X cuisine. And in some of the memoirs that I read, actually the ravioli book talked about this whole search about the original recipe for this ravioli. It turns out the grandma used cream cheese because she liked it better. So it was authentically her family, but right. It was not authentic to like the region in Italy that she could trace her her pedigree to.
So much of the story of immigration and food is about making those changes based on what's available. And so that's kind of part of the process.
Yeah. And actually, it's also the community building. So in some of the memoirs, what is so striking is that the family would gear up for a day's drive to go acquire authentic ingredients. Mm-hmm. Say, if you lived in Indiana, you'd go to Chicago and buy and stock up for a long time, but then you'd have peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to tide you over, so you didn't have to stop. You could just get there and spend a lot of time. And then, you know, at a certain point, the second or third generation says, well, it's okay that I use it with this because it reflects my reality.
Yeah. And also you talked about what we choose to eat and how we choose to eat and who we choose to eat in front of. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how that is featured with your kids, with people you know, with you as a child?
Yes, I think that in the memoirs in particular, in the lunchroom at the school cafeteria becomes mm-hmm. the site in which these identities are really hashed out. Recent immigrant children not only have the barrier of language, but also bring foods that they're comfortable with to the school cafeteria, and then they face that double rejection, maybe triple. It could be racial. It could be because of their linguistic inability to communicate with their friends, and then the smell of the food. So I think my children, when they're feeling most peevish, right, or more like they want to tease me, they tease me about my accent, and then they teach me about my smelly foods that I eat.
Oh, it's like you need to learn a gastronomic code switching in order to be proficient.
And kids do. In a lot of these memoirs, you know, the kids come home, it's like, I must have peanut butter and sandwich. I don't want to draw any attention to me. But then somebody like Diana Abu Jaber, who is her father is Jordanian and her mother was American, made a point of defiantly continuing to bring this food because it's delicious. And then gradually she saw the opposite. Oh, the kids are like, ooh, can I have some of that hummus? So she took a perverse pride in being able to convert people to her ethnic way of eating.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
It was really fun.
A pleasure.
Vivian Halloran wrote the book Immigrant Kitchen. She's also an associate professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University. Thanks to Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of IU's Food Institute for that conversation. Coming up, you'll go with us to Dan Williamson's home kitchen, where stuffed mushrooms and zucchini hash are on the menu. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. This is Earth Eats. Hi. Dan Williamson always knew that there was a time limit on his career as a chef. 15 hours a day on your feet in a hot kitchen just gets harder and harder as you age. When he was young, though, he cooked because he had to.
I grew up in a house with five sisters and just one mother raising us all in the 70s. So money was always an issue in our family. And because Mom often had two and sometimes three jobs, there were many times when the kids sort of took over the kitchen and were in charge of getting dinner ready and that sort of thing. So what I started doing early was experimenting in my mom's kitchen. I was second to the oldest, so there was a lot of sort of caregiving being passed around in our family. But it really helped us to be close, and we still are.
Growing up in Southern Ohio, he worked in kitchens to make some extra money. He furthered his career in Cincinnati and France. Now, 14 years after he left professional cooking, he's passing his love of food onto his 11-year-old daughter, Kate. I visited them one afternoon as they were doing a trial run of the dishes Dan will present at the winter brunch for the Community Kitchen of Monroe County. He's one of the guest chefs for the fundraiser. Dan starts by the stove. Kate is shredding some zucchini.
All right, you ready?
Yep.
Okay, so we're going to start off with the sauce. So we'll need to cut up some shallots and some garlic. And we'll get those started in some olive oil. We'll sweat those a little bit. We'll add maybe a little wine. Should we put wine in there?
Sure.
How often do you two cook together?
Actually pretty often. When he cooks, I'm typically there sometimes.
So we try, my kids are of an age where we run a lot on the weekends, so we try to cook as much as we can whenever we're home. Okay, so I'm going to cut these. How about you, so Kate got her first chef knife for her birthday this year, so why don't you cut the ends off these and then start shredding them so we can cook those off as well while I chop the mushrooms, okay?
When did you realize that she was into cooking?
Right away. One of her favorite movies was
The
Princess and the Frog. And of course, you know, it's set on the bayou and there was gumbo. And she also knew the story of me sort of winning my job in France by cooking Cajun food. And it's always been one of my favorites. So she just was kind of drawn to that.
And I only started watching it when I was a few years old, so at first it was just this really awesome movie before I started really, like, getting, oh, that looks good. And then I asked, like, I realized it was gumbo and asked Dad if we could make it.
Mmm, gumbo smells good, Tiana.
I think it's going, Daddy.
Yeah, are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely positive.
Yes.
Mmm.
What?
Well, sweetheart, this is the best gumbo I've ever tasted. Come here. You door, I look good. Got a gift.
All right. So we're looking for what happens to onions when they're cooked? They kind of become...
They become clear.
Yeah.
Like Caesar.
So we're just going to add a little wine. All right, so in go the tomatoes. Akuli is kind of a pureed, strained sauce rather than a stick to your pasta kind of sauce. And so we'll process it and then run it through a strainer or a food mill or something like that. Whatever you have is fine. When I first moved to Bloomington, my girlfriend at the time had moved here a little bit earlier than me because I had to stay behind to finish up a job as a sous chef of the Hyde Park Country Club in Cincinnati. And so we decided to have a party when I first got here so that I could meet all her new colleagues at work or at school and so forth, and then invite all of my friends that I knew as well. And so I cooked for a week, and we just put out a huge spread of just Cajun everything. And we invited everybody to come and bring musical instruments and wine and so forth, and we just had a party. Well, one of her professors at the last minute sort of called and said, "Can't make it, I'm entertaining some archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania." We said, "Well, does he play guitar?" And of course the answer was yes. And he came, we had fun and he ate lots of food. At the end of the night, he kind of came to me and said, "I would love for you to cook for me in the south of France. We do a dig there every summer, so it's all summer long, and we would be looking for somebody that could do this kind of thing." And so I said, "Sure." And I thought, well, he'll forget about it, or, you know. And a couple weeks later, I got an email from him, and he had it all laid out, and the dates, and what he could pay me, and that sort of thing. And so I went. So we had so much fun, and it went so well that they started inviting me back. And I ended up spending 7 summers there with them. And it allowed me to do things I had never imagined that, you know, a poor boy growing up in Southern Ohio would be able to do, like learn a second language. But I knew all along that it was kind of a young man's career. And eventually, like everything, I had to sort of walk away from it because, you know, the kids were coming along and that sort of thing. And that's one of the things that I didn't want to be, was absent from their lives, especially growing up. So I chose to give it up and find another career. Our stuffing's cooled a little bit, so we're going to add probably about 1/2 cup of breadcrumbs. So then we're going to add some sort of copious amounts of grated Parmesan. Now all that's left is stuffing the mushrooms and getting them in the oven. So Kate, if you want to help me with these, we'll just...
taking a bit, stuffing them in, and then putting them
in. So what I love about cooking is the sharing part, you know. When I see my family happy, you know, while we sit around the table and talk about our day and eat a good meal. And so, yeah, I still have a deep love for it, and... in some ways a bit of a yearning, but I would never turn back, because the moments that it's allowed me to have with my children, who I was thinking the other day that my daughter's only 7 years away from being out of the house and in college. So it's all gone by really so quickly that I'm just very thankful that I've been afforded the opportunity to be there and see all this.
Oh, Mom's home.
So you're just in time to try the mushrooms, babe.
Great. We're cooking zucchini hash and stuffed mushrooms with tomato sauce.
Cool. Why? What is in it?
So the mushrooms are stuffed with mushrooms and cheese, which is your favorite.
Yay! Favorite food is cheese of all time.
So probably what you'll do.
Jack is 9 years old. Nikki Williamson also joined us in the kitchen after getting home from work that day.
All right, bon appetit.
He's going for the mushroom.
Is he? That's surprising.
That's good.
Dan Williamson is the president of Bill Resch Insurance in Bloomington, Indiana. His daughter and sous chef is Kate. She's 11. Dan will be serving these stuffed mushrooms, tomato coulis, and zucchini hash on Sunday, February 12th at the Community Kitchen of Monroe County's Winter Brunch. I've posted more info about that, along with some photos, and of course, the recipes, at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.